pupils and the advanced. Here, I would like to bring myself into the picture. Each time when I type a new manuscript on my computer, I'm faced with the same dilemma. How do I explain what I think without continually repeating what I have already said elsewhere? The schoolteacher and the university lecturer have an easy time of it in comparison. Both start from the premise that their pupils have already mastered the rudiments of a subject and that they can therefore build on these foundations. Whoever fails to learn their ABC stays down instead of moving up a class. But an author cannot make such assumptions unless he wants to exclude new readers, preach only to the converted, or force them to go and buy his other books first. That may be good for his income, but it is not the most considerate approach. If he chooses to go down this path, he breeds a readership of specialists, a kind of insider elite, made up of those who are well informed. And the outsiders are soon left miles behind without any chance of following the debate. I cut through this Gordian knot by providing recapitulation wherever a new reader would need it, so as to follow what is going on. At the same time, I make sure, for the sake of those familiar with my arguments, that repetitions are never just repetitions. One can always enlarge and expand. Research never stands still, and I now know more about the Adam legend or about the antediluvian patriarch Enoch than I did 7 years ago. Diligent librarians keep hauling new piles of books into my study. Helpful readers draw my attention to additional sources. Scientists from various fields supply me with fresh information. Therefore, I have no alternative but to revise and expand old and familiar opinions. Those who have read my previous books can flick through such passages quickly, while the new pupil will be thankful for the recapitulation, even if it has, of necessity, to be brief. I assume that it is known that I believe extraterrestrials visited our Earth thousands of years ago. I have written 20 books and made a 25-part television series on this theme. I have also discussed at length the reasons for this visit and its technical details. I do not intend to go over that ground again at this point, nor to discuss again the countless archaeological indications supporting my theory that have been found all over the globe. My concern in this book is with a paleoceti philosophy. Paleo equals old, ancient from the Greek paleos. Ceti equals search for extraterrestrial intelligence. With a theory and edifice of ideas that illumines the sense of nonsense in religious views and beliefs and opens a new path of thinking about these matters. My intention is certainly not to found a new religion, nor, as my critics maliciously assert, a substitute religion. Religion demands faith, which has no place in my investigations. Religions offer promises, even beyond death. I am not promising a thing. Religions build churches and temples where they worship their gods and holy ones, apostles, saints, and prophets. In Paleoceti philosophy, there are neither temples nor worship. Religions also ultimately demand adherence to certain ethical norms. There is not the least trace of that in my supporters or me. And finally, religions insist on some yearly financial tribute. Do you, dear listener, feel financially exploited by buying this book or borrowing it? Another point of view. As the giant mother spaceship of the extraterrestrials cruised into our solar system, the ETs aboard had already known for a long time about the third planet. Only upon this blue planet did all the conditions for life exist. The strangers discovered a wealth of all forms of life, amongst which were our primitive ancestors. Though dumb and slow-witted, these represented the highest form of life upon the Earth at that time. The aliens therefore took one of the creatures and altered it genetically. No longer, these days, such an unthinkable idea. At some point or other, a group of extraterrestrials found that their experiment with the first Homo sapiens had succeeded, and that they could leave the Earth to this indigenous human being. He was certainly cleverer than all the other crawling and flying creatures. He also had the ideal tools to undertake whatever he wanted, his hands. For this being to multiply, a female was needed, Eve, or whatever the name of our primal mother may have been. The first intelligent human beings had no speech. How could they have done? Their direct ancestors were apes. They grunted and roared, so the extraterrestrials decided on a training program. The Homo sapiens pair were placed in a protected garden, Biosphere 1, and taught speech, as the Book of Genesis, chapter 11, verse 1, reports, "And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech." Adam was able, ultimately, to give a name to everything. The program would also have included moral education and practical instructions for developing agriculture and crafts. Another group of ETs experimented with the Earth's animals. Why should they do that? A space crew in a gigantic spaceship, a so-called space habitat, would certainly know other solar systems and planets besides the Earth. At the very least, their own solar system must have been familiar to them. Many of these other planets may have been larger or smaller than our planet, may have lain closer to or further from their respective suns, may therefore have been cooler, drier, or wetter, and subject either to stronger or weaker gravity. We know that there are myriads of life forms on the Earth that have adapted to the most inhospitable climates and conditions. The polar bear sleeps on the ice, something I would not recommend to a lion. A kangaroo takes giant leaps while the tortoise creeps along. Certain kinds of snake have adapted to tropical climates and freeze in the cold. Surely it would be an obvious thing to want to experiment with the genetic material available on the Earth, to find out which animals are best fitted for certain environmental conditions, and also which are the most resistant and best at surviving. Is that an absurd idea? We ourselves have done and do the same. Not until now by genetic means, but through breeding. We have bred German and Swiss cows which now graze happily in the tropical climate of Kenya. We have combined different breeds of oxen to produce stronger cows with a higher milk yield. We have crossed goats with sheep, geep. We have crossbred varieties of grain to make them better adapted to a new environment. And now we have started producing genetically engineered vegetables. There is absolutely no knowing what our scientists may still come up with. Who is to say that we will not suddenly genetically engineer a person who lives to the age of 240? This is how the monsters and mixed breed beings appeared that had not previously existed on Earth. The human beings talked excitedly about them. These divine creatures astonished and frightened them. And once they had died out or been destroyed in the flood, these horror movie beasts walked straight into folk memory. They were elevated to myth and legend, symbols of a far distant time when the gods had created all kinds of beings. I am not, however, underestimating the human power of imagination. The Greek poet Homer, about 800 BC, described the sirens in the Adventures of Odysseus, who sang so bewitchingly that seafarers lost their will and memory. Although Homer does not describe these sirens in any detail, the imagination of later authors depicted them as winged women with the feet of birds. There was also the Greek Hesiod, about 700 BC, who made up the monstrous Medusa, from whose head snakes writhed and flickered, and whose appearance was so terrifying that it turned people to stone. Of course, Hesiod never actually saw a Medusa. We also know the legends of the flying horse, Pegasus, and the phoenix which rises from the ashes. All these and much more arose from human imagination, upon which all folk tales depend. But imagination does not stem from nothing. It needs points of reference to spark it off. Even if our logical reason still resists the idea of a zoo of monsters that is supposed to have lived once upon a time, this resistance does not alter two unavoidable facts. Ancient writers and historians described these creatures and also asserted that they had been created by the gods. The stonemasons and stuccoists of thousands of years ago preserved these mixed beings for eternity. The sex-hungry angels. In the mother spacecraft, meanwhile, mutiny had broken out. Some of the higher-ranking officers had quite different ideas from the commander, the highest. Whether the leader of the rebels was called Ishmael, Lucifer, or anything else has little relevance. The legend described him as the greatest prince among the others. In the science fiction story Star Trek, he would no doubt be called First Officer. Whatever his name, Ishmael, alias XY, seems to have had more power than the rest of the crew, for he was the only one to possess 12 pairs of wings. Ishmael and his renegades lost the battle on board and were thrown out of heaven. This does not seem, to begin with, at any rate, to have bothered them much. They probably thought that their technical know-how would ensure that they regained the upper hand. Hardly had they arrived on Earth than the expelled crowd developed a hearty appetite for sex. In the legend, the leader Ishmael promptly seduced Eve. And behold, he resembled not earthly, but heavenly ones. Other crew members snapped up, according to taste, pretty girls and also boys. Even steadfast believers in the Bible cannot get past this passage from the book of Genesis, chapter 6, verse 1. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. The learned dispute which has raged since time immemorial around that little phrase, sons of God, and which has produced thousands of pages of conflicting and contradictory commentary, will raise only a bored smile from anyone with a bit of inside knowledge. Sons of God is variously translated as giants, children of God, fallen angels, or perhaps renegade spirit beings. It is enough to make one want to scream. A single little phrase turns belief on its head. Every specialist who has a sure knowledge of Hebrew can tell you exactly what these syllables mean. The ones who had descended were similar to men and much larger than human beings. But one is not allowed to say what one thinks. I do, though, and without any ifs or buts. The old objection that extraterrestrials could never pair up with Earth people has long since been dismissed. I do not need to repeat myself on this point. And the gods created men in their image. In this drama of prehistory, the highest, the commander of the spaceship, obviously possessed better maps than his renegade crew. With concern, he watched the goings-on on Earth. The crossbreeding of ETs with people gave rise to creatures which were wholly inconsistent with the planned race of Homo sapiens. This was the original sin of mythology. Human beings were now inheriting the wrong genetic messages. And it repented the Lord that he had the Earth, and it grieved him at his heart, it says in Genesis, chapter 6, verse 6. The highest must somehow now interrupt the human being experiment and begin afresh. But how? The renegade angels probably possessed powerful weapons. They could hide away in caves and hold out inside buildings. There was no possibility of hunting the evil ones individually. We cannot gather from the legends and religious texts whether the flood was caused intentionally or whether a large meteor collided with the earth. An artificial flood is possible. We still do such things today. And meteorites are constantly raining down upon the earth. Whichever it was, the highest must have been informed about the exact time that the flood would take place, which is how he could warn the good ones and advise them about their ship construction. Science and theology. I myself do not see much future for the kind of theology we have known until now. Theologians may believe in revelations, but they will never manage to make rational what is, by its nature, irrational. That does not mean that I dispute the scientific approach of systematic theology, in which texts are compared with known historical events, handwritten scripts are examined, and an attempt is made to evaluate a number of different accounts through comparative analysis. For example, which prophets and when made reference to the Messiah? Which of their statements are incomprehensible, and to which should we attach less importance? What do all these statements have in common, and with which other account does a particular prophet's description agree? If theologians would simply call this science, I would have no argument with them, apart from the term theology itself. This derives from theos, God, and logos, word, and thus means the word of God. But this is precisely what theology is not. Of course it is true that all theologians are convinced that they are concerned with the word of God, otherwise they would never have chosen this profession. But such a conviction is already faith. They have faith that the holy and not so holy texts once came from the mouth of God, that he dictated them or revealed them to the chosen few. But what remains of these texts once the ingredient of faith is withdrawn? What is left are the texts themselves. They have simply lost their holiness. They may remain venerable because of their great age. We can treat them with respect because they describe occurrences from a time inaccessible to history. We can analyze them scientifically because they contain much that is of great interest. Once belief in the holiness of these texts is dispensed with, we can really start getting to grips with them. It is actually our idea of their holiness that prevents a modern analysis of their significance. On the other hand, Paleoceti philosophy is also just a point of view, a theory. It provides a very helpful foundation, but cannot yet be proved. Is theology any different? Are there any precise scientific proofs for its assumptions? It is well known that there is nothing more subjective than taste or opinion. Therefore, there is no point in arguing about them. Yet people do argue, because the generation gap, coupled with the spirit of the times, causes uproar in their inner lives. Some want to hold fast to the safe stronghold of belief. Others want explanations that hold scientific water. Science comes from the word scientia, knowledge. The knowledge of theology is useless to exact science. It is full of contradictions and ultimately remains a matter of belief and feeling. The same is true of Paleoceti philosophy. But the latter develops a clear thread, a train of thought which employs reason and makes the incomprehensible more accessible. Paleoceti philosophy makes sense of what was previously nonsense. Occultists might as well put away their crystal balls. The members of secret brotherhoods can close up their shops, for the wares of belief that sold so well through millennia are less and less in demand. Only modern scientific knowledge can provide us with an understandable interpretation of the past, and this is not by pure chance either. It lies in the nature of things. Apples fall when they are ripe, and my grandfather could never have conceived of the ideas which I now propound. Space travel was unheard of in his day. He knew nothing at all of genes and genetic engineering. And angels were for him inviolable messengers of God. He would have thought a hologram was a vision, and a television, speaking glass. Praised be the sacred Berlitz stone. It is not because we are drawing close to the end of the millennium that the veils have lifted, but because science and technology have flung wide the gates. If people had not started discussing the possibility of space travel, or invented the computer, or unlocked the secrets of the genetic code until the year 2100, we would not, until then, have been in a position to examine the questions which such things have thrown up. Let us imagine that my great-great-grandfather had stumbled upon some wonderful find 200 years ago. Say he had discovered engraved tablets which, when deciphered by learned men, told of a journey from a far distant world to the earth, and of the traveler's unfriendly reception by earth's inhabitants. What would have been made of such a text 200 years ago? An enormous power of imagination would have been attributed to the unknown author. The text would have been seen in terms of allegory and symbolism. People would have extracted from it some kind of moral, such as that we should be friendly to strangers, even if we do not know where they have come from. But the real possibility of space travel would have been quite beyond their grasp. So I believe that we should bring a modern view to bear upon the age-old questions of humanity. Such questions may well have become much easier to solve than in days of my great-great-grandfather. We do not suffer from excommunication or witch hunts anymore, and modern means of communication allow the rapid development and spread of new theories. I can understand why some people, entrenched in their old beliefs, want to fight a rearguard action to dam the flood tide of new discovery. They may hold it up for a little while, but no power on earth is going to stop the arrival of the future. Things which are forbidden by religion and ideology in one country have a habit of turning up in a still more radical form in another. Critics continually ask me what makes me so sure that I am on the right track. They tell me my views are nothing more than a fixed idea, and unprovable. They also accuse me of using only those passages from legends and mythology in a very selective way, which support my theories. The right selection. But why am I accused of doing what everyone must do, given the enormous wealth of material? Every book I read is a selection which the author has chosen to support his views. The objection that scientific investigations do not approach the material in this way is a pure fantasy, in which only unkissed students believe. In the last 4 years, I have devoured about 300 theological works, and the conclusion of each one supported the author's opinion. Countless cross-references are used, especially in PhD theses, to show that the author's opponents are misguided in one or another respect. The flood of literature on every subject has become so immense that no author in the world can still retain an overview or take account of all the works of his predecessors. One has to select, silently throwing the ballast overboard in the process. The subject specialist has a broad knowledge of the opinions he opposes, which the layman does not particularly want to bother with. The publishers and booksellers still less. We should recognize that selection is unavoidable and admit honestly that an author says what he wants to say and makes clear the line of inquiry he is pursuing. Religious texts are riddled with morality and ethics, which do not interest me in the least. That is why I do not bother with the hundreds of pages of the prophets' warnings, threats, prophecies, and instructions. It is not my business to explain to the listener why one should not eat pork, and on what grounds one should repudiate one's wife. Every specialist knows, anyway, that prophets' utterances are very rarely authentic or original. Later generations have added, extended, and spiced up these texts to their taste. And also, in respect of religious chronology, what good are passages such as Terah begat Abraham, Abraham begat Isaac, when Abraham probably never existed? What? But there are texts about Abraham, stories have been written about him, and in the Apocalypse of Abraham, experiences are described in specific detail. That is right. There are such texts, and ones which are very useful for my work. But this does not prove that we are dealing here with original sources from Abraham's hand, or from those close to him. In the Chronicles of Jeremiel, which are based on still older sources, it is asserted that Abraham was a very great astrologer and magician. He was said to have received his knowledge directly from the angels. We, as people of a Christian culture, have had it drummed into us that Abraham was the progenitor of humanity. But in fact, the researchers are not even agreed that he actually existed and what his name signifies. Franz M. Boll, professor at the University of Leiden, states, "The name Abram, which appears only in Genesis chapter 11:26 through 17:5, means the sublime father, or the father is sublime. One can take the word patriarch itself as a translation of this name. Abraham is probably only a dialect variant, an expansion of the more common name Abram." This passage was written in 1930. But later investigators came to a similar conclusion. 5 years after Professor Boll, the Journal of Biblical Literature noted succinctly, "Abraham was originally not a personal name, but the name of a divinity." The 60 years of Abraham research which have passed since then have shed no new light on the subject. In a publication from Yale University, I read the following noteworthy passage. We will probably never be in a position to prove that Abraham really existed. What need is there, then, in the face of this theological confusion, to take heed in my work of the chronological dates of any prophet's sayings, especially since the same sort of doubt hangs over other prophets as well? Ezekiel, one of the prime witnesses in my case for Paleoceti philosophy, had to pass through countless transformations throughout the centuries. In a work which appeared in 1981, no less than 270 treatises on the prophet are examined. 270 wise heads devoted years of their lives to Ezekiel research. The figure of this prophet underwent, in the process, extraordinary transformations. Originally, his word was beyond reproach. Then he became a visionary, subsequently a dreamer and idealist, and most recently he has been considered a cataleptic, that is, a schizophrenic subject to fits. The Ezekiel texts were also dissected. Experts on semantics discovered that style and vocabulary showed that they were written by more than one author. The poor prophet was declared to be a pseudo-Ezekiel, whose book had been cobbled together 200 years after the death of Christ from a variety of other different texts. 100 years ago, however, the theology professor Rudolf Smend could still write, "There can be no doubt that the text is based on a visionary experience, which is by no means just attributable to a particular convention of written style." And today, most theologians believe that the book of Ezekiel is the work of several editors, which includes the work of the prophet himself as well as additions inserted at various periods. Who can really hold it against me, then, if I select the freshest leaves from this salad of confusion? It is a salad which also contains indigestible spices. There are names and dates which appear in the holy books, which belong in the salad as little as sliced shoe soles. Take this passage from the book of Genesis, for instance, chapter 15, verses 13 and 16. "And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years, but in the fourth generation they shall come hither again." The British archaeologist Kathleen M. Kenyon noted sourly to this, "The chronology contradicts itself. To accept that their stay lasted 400 years, and yet simultaneously to be told that the fourth generation after the entry to Egypt would be involved in the Exodus, are two so obviously incompatible assertions that one is forced to regard them as unhistorical." Theological viewpoints are not only opaque, they also alter from one professor and from one decade to another. So what are we left with? The mysterious accounts themselves. The sort of stories in which the author writes in the first person, that is, retells a personal experience. As in legend and myth, religious literature retains a core, a nugget of truth. It is that mysterious aspect that later editors hardly altered. Why not? Partly because they did not understand it. The mystery stuck to the prophet's words and was handed down to succeeding generations. Partly also because they did not dare to put their own words into a venerable prophet's mouth in a wholesale fashion. They would then have had to lie in the first person. The original personal experience of, "I saw, I heard, the Highest spoke to me," came from a primeval ancient source. The later editors only tinkered around with it, trying to make sense of the incomprehensible. And because they did not understand it themselves, we are left today with perfect chaos. If only they had just copied the old texts without making alterations. But for a thinking person, this is well-nigh impossible. We cannot even do it nowadays. We already have versions of the New Testament in the form of comics and other still worse adulterations, ostensibly to make the holy text relevant to our times. Yet, from unclean means comes an unclean result. Mahatma Gandhi, 1869 to 1948. Making selections. My process of selection overlooks all that is completely incomprehensible to present-day understanding. That does not mean that we will not be analyzing these things again from a different perspective in 20 years' time. Whoever says that such a process is unscientific, that one should not proceed in such a way, should take a look at the Jewish scholars who have faced exactly the same problem for centuries and millennia. They did not understand the significance of the old texts either. So every word, every phrase was turned this way and that, and constantly reinterpreted and reformulated. There is written proof of this in the many Midrash books. The well-known Midrashim literature contains the textual research of the wisest Jewish minds over many centuries. Such interpretation goes on for hundreds of pages. New names, new points of view. And all of it only proves that the greatest Jewish scholars no longer understood the original texts. So how do I make my selections? How do I proceed? How can I know better than the scholars of the past and decide which passages were once original and which were not? When the life of Abraham is described in terms such as that angels descended at his birth, and that he held his own against King Nimrod of Babylon, I assume that this is all the pious addition of later editors. They were concerned to give Abraham a strong profile and a fittingly glorious origin. But whenever Abraham, or whoever he was, the name is irrelevant, starts speaking in the first person, I prick up my ears. I home in on such passages, especially when they describe some astonishing episode connected with space, which later editors would not have invented, because they would not have had access to such detailed knowledge. In the text which theologians call the Apocalypse of Abraham, the author, let us call him XY, describes two heavenly beings who descend to earth. These two heavenly beings carried Abraham up to the heights, for the highest wished to converse with him. Abraham relates that they were not human, and that he was very afraid of them. He describes them as having a shining body like a sapphire. They took him upwards in smoke and fire, as if with the force of many winds. Once arrived in the heights, he saw a glorious light beyond description, and great figures who shouted words to each other, which I do not understand. And for anyone who still has not grasped where he has got to, he makes it even clearer. But I wish to fall back down to the earth. The high place where we stood was at one moment upright, at another moment it turned upon its head. So someone is telling us, in the first-person narrative form, that he wanted to fall back down to the earth. It is logical to assume, therefore, that he was above the earth. And why could a later editor not have invented the text? Because no one could have known that gigantic spacecraft, like the space stations of the future, always turn on their own axis. It is only through the centrifugal force caused by a spaceship's own rotation that an artificial gravity can be engineered. And what does Abraham's apocalypse say? The high place where we stood was at one moment upright, at another moment it stood upon its head. Coincidence? Just foolish fantasy? Why does Abraham insist that these beings were not human, and that their suits glittered like sapphire? Such texts are actually crystal clear, and their time has come. Modern man has had about enough of having religious fairy tales forced down his throat. There is a new, modern interpretation of the old texts and traditions, which makes all clear in an instant. Just before I launch into a quite new chapter, I would like, for the last time, to rekindle an old fire that I have often returned to in the course of the years. There is hardly a single one of my books which does not mention the prophet Enoch. I shall not go back exhaustively over the old ground now, but I would still like to hammer a few posts into it as markers that modern exegetes will find hard to ignore. Enoch. Once more. Who was Enoch? The ancient Jewish tales describe him as a king over men, who ruled for 243 years. He was full of wisdom, which he dispensed to all the world. He was the builder of the great Egyptian pyramids, according to the geographer and historian Taki al-Makrizi, 1364-1442. In his work Hittat, he mentions that Enoch was known by four different names: Sorid, Hermes, Idris, and Enoch. The following passage is quoted from Hittat, chapter 33. The first Hermes, known as the Threefold One in his qualities of prophet, king, and wise man, read in the stars that the flood would come. Then he ordained that the pyramids should be built, and in them he hid treasures, texts and scripts, and everything which might otherwise be lost, so that they might be preserved. The Arabic word Idris means progenitor, or primal father of wisdom, and for both Jewish and Christian theology, Enoch is the seventh of the 10 original patriarchs before the flood. Enoch was the father of Methuselah, who was supposed to have lived to the biblical age of 969. In the Old Testament, Enoch shows up for just five verses, Genesis chapter 5, verses 21-24. And then it says, "And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. And hey, presto, he vanished." In Hebrew, the word Enoch means the initiate, or the insightful one. Thank God this initiate made sure that his knowledge did not vanish without trace, to the annoyance of the Orthodox, who would prefer it if it had vanished into thin air, for he was an assiduous writer. And this is what started all the trouble. There are two books, which are not included in the Old Testament, but are among the apocryphal texts. The church fathers who put together the Bible did not know what to do with the Enoch texts. They excluded them because they did not understand them. But the Ethiopian church ignored the orders of the ruling ecclesiasts, so the Enoch book ended up in the Abyssinian canon. A Slavic variant of the same book also turned up. Textual comparisons between the two by specialists showed conclusively that they both derived from one original source, written by one author, none other than Enoch. So who was he? I am continually astonished by the short-sightedness of different exegetes. If a text fits in with their convictions, they consider it genuine. If it does not, it must be false. The Book of Enoch is not only written in the first person, but the author also continually makes reference to his own authorship, as though he was afraid that future minds might be too narrow to recognize the fact. I would like to cite two textual examples which demonstrate clear indications of Enoch's authorship. An Eyewitness Report. In the first month of my 365th year, on the first day of the first month, I, Enoch, was alone in my house, and there appeared unto me two great figures of men, such as I had never seen before upon the earth. This is the full and true teaching of wisdom, written by the author Enoch. And now, my son Methuselah, I tell you all and write it down for you. I have revealed all these things to you and passed on to you the books which concern them. Preserve, my son Methuselah, these books from your father's hand, and pass them down to the future generations of the world. You cannot get much clearer than that. The original source of the Book of Enoch comes from the Enoch who lived before the flood, for he refers to his son as Methuselah. To assert that that is all just a pre-Christian falsification is to accuse the author of unadulterated lies. To attribute the Book of Enoch to sources other than the Enoch who lived before the flood is a disgrace to the discipline of textual research. It is also a horrendous example of manipulation of the devout, who are supposed to swallow whatever predigested fare is offered them. Of course, researchers also attempt to dismiss the embarrassing Enoch texts as visions. This little word is stretched to cover everything that passes our understanding. The vision proponents overlook the fact that Enoch expressly says he was in a state of wakefulness. In addition, he gives his family exact instructions for the period of his absence. This also cannot have been a deathbed vision, for after his conversations with the angels, he returns fit as a faithful fiddle to his relatives. Not until much later does he vanish into the clouds in a fiery chariot. So what is so important about this Enoch book? Quite simply, it represents the corroboration of a Paleo-Seti philosophy. As in the Old Testament, Enoch gives an account of what happens when angels mutiny. When angels mutiny. In the book of Enoch, chapter 6, verses 1 through 6, it says, "As the children of men multiplied, lovely and loving daughters were born unto them. When the angels, the sons of heaven, caught sight of them, they lusted after them, and they spoke to one another, 'Let us take to ourselves wives from among the children of men, that they bear us children.' Then their leader, Semyazah, spoke to them, 'I fear that you will not go through with this thing. Then would I be made to bear the penalty for a great transgression.' Then all replied unto him, 'Then let us swear an oath and bind ourselves not to give up this plan, but to carry it out.' So all swore an oath and bound themselves to it. There were in all 200, who in the days of Jared descended from the peak of the Mount of Hermon." If this is not mutiny of the sons of heaven, what is it? It is quite clear what was going on. For, chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, "All of them took wives unto themselves. Then they began to go to them, and to do impure acts with them. And they taught them the arts of magic and herbs, and showed them plant lore. Then their wives were with child, and gave birth to giants 300 feet tall. These devoured all the provisions of the other people, but when there was no more to feed them with, the giants turned against them and ate them up. And they began to devour birds, wild animals, creeping things and fish, and also the flesh and blood of one another. Then the earth cried aloud against these fiends." The pre-flood scenario is described in realistic detail, even if it appears unbelievable to us nowadays. The good angels, the ones who had not become involved in the mutiny, observed all this from above. They reported to the highest, and he decided on action. "The whole earth shall go under. A flood of water shall come upon the whole earth and destroy all things." What is remarkable about the Enoch book are the many details not to be found in any other text. In chapter 69, Enoch even lists the names of the leaders of the mutiny and describes all their ranks and functions. Because I know from my readers' letters that they are unlikely to come across a copy of the Book of Enoch in their local libraries, or that they don't have the time to dig up a copy of it from somewhere, I will reproduce the text here. Enoch wished it to become widely known. Me too. And these are their names. The first of them is Semjasa, the second Artakisa, the third Armen, the fourth Kokabel, the fifth Tuarel, the sixth Rumjal, the seventh Danjal, the eighth Rakael, the ninth Barakel, the tenth Azazael, the 11th Amaros, the 12th Batarjal, the 13th, Busasajal, the 14th, Hananel, the 15th, Turel, the 16th, Semapesiel, the 17th, Jetrel, the 18th, Tumael, the 19th, Tarel, the 20th, Rumael, the 21st, Jesil. All these are the names of their leaders over 150 and 10. The name of the first is Jegun. He it is who led into temptation all the children of the angels, who did bring them down upon the fixed land and seduced them through the daughters of men. The second is called Asbil. It was he who gave unto the children of the angels bad counsel, so that they did harm unto their bodies through the daughters of men. The third is named Gadriel. He it is who did show unto the children of men all kind of death-bringing blows. He did also show them instruments of murder, armor, shield, the sword, and all the instruments of death that there be. Through his hand did they spread weapons to the inhabitants of the fixed land for all times. The fourth is named Penemua. He it was who did teach the children of men how to divide bitter from sweet, and showed them all secrets of their wisdom. He did teach men writing with ink and paper. The fifth is named Kasdeja. He it was who showed unto the children of men all kinds of evil blows of spirits and demons, even so the blows against the fruit of the mother's womb, so that it would be discharged. Also the blows against the soul, the snake bite, the fire blows, and the son of the snake. The Tabat? This has a question mark in every translation. The spelling of the names varies, though, from translation to translation. I won't bother you with a commentary on this text. After all, you can read as well as I. So what happened to Enoch? Where did his bones come to rest? Where is the temple or cathedral erected in his honor? A rather troubled ascension. It is not to be found on this earth. The Old Testament allows Enoch to disappear without trace. The Lord is supposed to have taken him. Or, according to which biblical version you follow, he rose up into the clouds on a fiery chariot. The ancient Jewish tales are more precise about his takeoff. The angels apparently had promised to take Enoch with them, but the date of departure had not yet been fixed. I received word that I would journey into the heavens, yet upon which day I go from you I know not yet. So Enoch gathered people around him, and told them of everything that the angels had told him. In particular, he told them not to hide his books away and keep them secret, but to make them accessible to future generations, which is a call I myself heed. After a few days of dispensing his wisdom, things became exciting. But it happened at the same time that the people were gathered around Enoch, and he was speaking unto them, that they lifted their eyes and saw the figure of a steed descending from heaven to the earth as though in a rushing storm. Then the people said unto Enoch what they saw, and Enoch spoke to them, "For my sake has this steed descended to the earth. The time has come, and the day, upon which I go from you, and see you nevermore." Then also was the steed there, and all the children of men saw it with their own eyes. It is clear that Enoch had been told by the heavenly ones that the takeoff would be very dangerous for all bystanders, so he tried to hold them back. He warned the watchers several times not to follow him, so that you will not die. A few hesitated and stayed well back, but the most obstinate wanted to get a good close look at Enoch's departure. They spoke to him, "We will accompany you to the place to which you go. Only death itself will divide us from you." Since they would not attend to his words, he spoke no more with them, and they followed him and did not turn back. And so it came to pass that Enoch rose up to heaven in a storm, on fiery steeds, in a fiery chariot. This ascent to the clouds ended in death for all the observers. The next day, people came to search for those who had accompanied Enoch. And they sought them at the place whence Enoch rose up to heaven. And when they came to the place, they found the earth covered with snow, and upon the snow lay great stones like unto hailstones. Then each spoke to the other, "Let us dig away the snow, and see if we may not find those who accompanied Enoch." And they dug it away, and found those who had gone with Enoch, lying dead beneath the snow. They sought also for Enoch, but found him not, for he had risen into the heavens. This took place in the year 113 of the life of Lamech, the son of Methuselah. So we are faced with yet another impossibility after the fall and the flood. But we will by now have ceased to be astonished, for all previous textual interpretations are riddled with impossibility. We are supposed to believe that our dear, loving God just stood back and watched as hundreds or perhaps thousands of observers burned to ashes while their teacher, Enoch, rose to the heavens. What misdeeds had they done? They had listened to the wisdom of Enoch. They accompanied him to the takeoff spot. Enoch rose in a storm on a fiery chariot up to heaven, while below him the recipients of his wisdom burned, together with the earth and stones, to a snow-white ash. Some forms of limestone become snow-white at great heat. None of these events, the fall, the flood, the ascension of Enoch, or indeed the space travel of Abraham, fit with the image of a loving God. Why should an all-present God call Abraham to him to talk with him? He must know, being all-knowing, what Abraham is thinking and feeling. Why should our dear God need a spaceship that revolves upon its own axis above the earth? Why must God first send two figures to fetch Abraham? Why does he need fiery horses to carry Enoch to heaven? The answers to these questions are always the same. The highest, the God described here, can never in 1,000 years be the same as the all-present Creator honored by all religions and by me. I consider it an insult to the true God to ascribe such mistakes and cruelty to him. But if we replace God or the highest with extraterrestrial space travelers, the paradoxical events become understandable. We can then understand who these fallen angels were and why they satisfied their sexual lust. We can understand the reasons for a flood and for the desire of the highest to communicate with individual human beings. And we can understand why the many people who did not heed Enoch's warning were burned to death. This also makes comprehensible people's fear of the day of judgment, of some kind of universal settling of accounts, for the highest had promised to return.